So lovely to see some familiar faces already in this conference. I just wish I was with you, but it's lovely to be here and also to hear from some new faces as well. So anyone who read my abstract, I realized when I then came to write the paper that it was really an abstract for a book. So I'm not going to deliver on everything, I promise, but I hope there'll be a little bit of something for everybody. This is broadly what I'm going to try and cover. So a little bit of background. A framework for analysis, which I then won't really use, but I think it will set out the problem. And then some key voices in research, advocacy, and policy making, and then looking at some impacts and the results since 1945. So, what I was interested in really was thinking about the institutional side of the growth in institutional support for languages since 1945, and that's more or less what I'm going to try and focus on. But as others have said, I think Richard said it in his paper already, it's not as if 1945 was an absolute break for us, and there was already quite a lot of advocacy and institutional work going on before that. So I've given various examples on the slide there. The Modern Language Association was founded in the late 19th century. There was a report on teaching qualifications for teaching modern languages in the early 20th century. Various investigations by various government bodies, but also the Incorporated Association of Assistant Masters in Secondary School, so a kind of advocacy body, not a government body, all looking and reflecting on teaching languages and what needed to be done or what was already being done well. And there were already some incremental changes underway. I could give lots of examples, but I thought I'd just pick out a few from the assessment end of the spectrum on the basis that what happens in assessment really does affect what goes on in the classroom, the washback effect, as Weir has called it. So already before 1945, the spoken language was inching its way to greater prominence. One of the examination boards, the JMB, which is short for the Joint Matriculation Board, made oral exams compulsory as early as 1932, and reading comprehension was being introduced. So we were moving away already from what had seemed like such an ossified traditional assessment diet of grammar and translation, inch by inch already. And as those people who heard Richard's paper yesterday will also have seen him talk about, again, 1945 from a theoretical point of view isn't such a clear break either. We can identify the reform movement period up to around 1920, and then what Harriet Smith and I follow them, the scientific period, the sort of the birth of trying to link teaching practice to insights from sciences, whether they're social sciences, psychology, education. So again, not such a break there. But on the other hand, there was a bit of a change of mood post-1945, particularly in the light of the intensive language teaching experiments that had happened as a result of World War II, particularly in the US Army. So I'm not going to go into that if that's been quite well researched, but I thought what is interesting is just to see how conscious languages and foreign languages teachers were of these changes. So in an article that was published in Hispania, the Journal of Hispanic Studies in the United States, there was a review, a very nice review article of recent publications, and quite a lot of these talk about the challenge to language teaching that's coming from what purports to be a scientific approach to language teaching. So it comes to languages, but is it science? Was one article, which was described in this review as a response to an article in a popular magazine, Science Comes to Languages. And another article talks about audiovisual aids as standing in relation to language teaching as laboratories do to the sciences. So this scientification in approach embraced by at least some people within language teaching. A couple of other publications that indicate this sense of a new future opening up after World War II. Alison Piers, who was a Hispanic scholar, had a publication on new tongues or modern language teaching of the future. And then Ernst Rose in the German space, The Future of Modern Language Teaching, similarly. So if you're interested, there's an article by Paul Sender and Phillips. If you Google Periscope in Hispania, I think you'll find that. So much for things up to 1945 and this sense of change after 1945. I just want to spend a couple of minutes thinking about how to analyse what happened after what's happened since 1945, particularly in terms of policy making and how that affects what actually happens in reality. So what I've got here is one of many, many sort of policy wheels that you can see, that policy cycles that all suggest you do some research and then you identify some policy options and then you develop them and then you implement them in some way, perhaps by changing your organization, and then you monitor, and it all looks very neat and smooth. And that's not actually a very good way of capturing what's happened, certainly with modern language learning in the UK since 1945. So another approach that I quite like is that of Johnson & Johnson. They talk about a policy funnel. So this is probably a bit small on your screen, but the idea here is they're talking about educational language policy from a federal level in the first funnel, and then it filters down through and becomes at state level and then down to the district level. And part of their argument is that at these kind of node points where it narrows down, where the filter narrows down, you have arbiters through whom the policy is funneled. And for an arbiter for them is any language policy actor, might be a teacher, administrator, a policymaker, who has a particular disproportionate amount of power in exactly interpreting what that policy turns into and how it gets appropriated. So I find that quite a useful way of thinking about it. But again, it's quite complicated. So if we just look at England, and I am going to say a little bit about Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, but really only briefly. Here's what the funnel in England for languages teaching might look like. So you have government policy set by the Department for Education. We have that feeds into a national curriculum, which has been in existence since 1988. That in turn influences what's called Ofqual, the Office of Qualifications and Examinations Regulation, who set up subject content statements, which is a document that says what has to be taught, what needs to be covered in a particular subject. That then gets interpreted by the exam boards, which are, in what I think is just really bizarre, there's three at the moment in England. One is OCR, which is the descendant of an Oxford and Cambridge board. Actually, they don't run language exams anymore, which is already a policy decision that's quite important, but they were. So that's run by a university agency. EdXL is run by a private company, Pearson, and AQA, which is also the descendant of another university exam board, which is operated as a charity. Each of those three exam boards interprets the subject content and comes up with subject specifications, which are accredited by that Ofqual organisation. And that turns into textbooks for each exam board, which I think I've lost the picture of, but I did have a picture showing the three types of different textbooks for the different exam boards. Those textbooks then are used as a basis, along with other materials, for teachers to produce schemes of work in the school. They split that curriculum that maybe covers 2 or 3 years into shorter units of work, into short units of 2 or 3 weeks, and that then gets translated into lesson plans and into in-school assessments. So that's what the funnel looks like, and on the right-hand side, the arbiters might include the groups who are actually involved in producing the subject content statement and the subject associations who might feed into the consultation process. Textbook authors obviously have a really important role in interpreting the specifications and turning them into good teaching material. And then the teachers who produce the scheme of work, perhaps for a group of teachers in their school. It's also worth adding, bearing in mind beyond the narrow group of arbiters and the policymakers, and implementers, lots of stakeholders with an interested voice. I won't go into all of these here. The one that you probably are not familiar with as a notion of is Ofsted, which I can't remember what it stands for exactly, but it's the Office of School Inspectorates for Education. So they are what accredit schools and rate them and give them a ranking as being outstanding, good, or in need of improvement. So lots of different stakeholders, which also complicate the picture. And then when we get to the level of the school in England, our school context is quite a complicated one as well. So we have What tends to get talked about is the state education system, but actually there's an independent school sector, makes up about 5% of the school system. There are selective state schools in some regions, grammar schools. To complicate matters further, some of the ones that are called grammar school are actually independent fee-paying schools. Then there are comprehensive state schools funded by the local education authority. And increasingly over the last decade or so, many standard state schools have been turned into academies, some of them run by multi-academy trusts. And what that means is that they're funded directly by the government, not by their local education authority. And that gives them more autonomy over their finances, their staffing structure. And they're not actually technically obliged to teach the national curriculum, although most do in the usual way. So we've got all those levels of funneling through policy. And then in terms of advocacy and lobbying, there are many different voices too, some of which I'll say a little bit more about. A lot of the ones on the list here, I'm not going to say much more about. So the British Council, I will say a little bit more about in a few slides' time. The British Academy is the sort of the very prestigious organisation of leading academics in the arts and humanities, which has quite an important lobbying voice of university academics. The Association for Language Learning is the language teachers association in schools. Alongside that, there's one specific to the independent schools. So ISMLA, the Independent Schools Modern Language Association. There's also a University Council of Modern Languages. There's individual subject associations, lots of other informal advocacy groups. And interestingly, since 2008, there's an all-parliamentary group for languages, which means a group of interested MPs chaired by a couple of really engaged members of parliament who advocate and help try and get the case across to government on languages matters. And then there's the fact that some of the most far-reaching or influential things that happen in languages are not the direct result of language-specific policy at all. So a few examples, the GCSEs, the General Certificate of School Education exams taken at 16. From 2004, a language ceased to be compulsory. That was a very big decision, which was about GCSEs in general. From 2010, something called the English Baccalaureate was introduced, which does include a foreign language. And that too may increase the inclination of schools to encourage students to take up a language which they might not otherwise do, because achieving the BAC, so in the EBAC, getting 5 good GCSEs is a marker of according to which schools are judged and ranked. And finally, another example at university level, the decision to make to call languages in 2005 one of a group of strategically important vulnerable subjects was a positive step, which ring-fenced a little bit of funding for those subject areas, but it's no longer applicable. And meanwhile, a really important thing, which is beyond the control of any individual group at the moment, is the fact that more and more universities are closing or substantially reducing their modern languages units. And that's always a management decision within a university that seems to make good sense to the people running the university, but which is having a big impact nationally on the availability of languages. Also bearing in mind that we in the UK have a devolved administration, so Scotland, Ireland and Northern Ireland and Wales can do their own thing. Scotland has a 1+2 approach to languages, so the EU approach, and you can see there that Scottish primary schools on the whole do have language learning in place, and in secondary schools 70% are offering the entitlement of 2 languages in the first 3 years of secondary school, though it's not yet been reflected in terms of numbers of pupils carrying on with languages to higher levels. In Wales, there's a very new hot off the press Global Futures Plan to promote modern languages, the curriculum for Wales 2022 will include 1 or more international languages for all learners from primary school until the end of year 9. International languages is the label here because bearing in mind Wales has Welsh as its as another language, or indeed English alongside Welsh as another language for many pupils already. So the linguistic picture is already more complicated there. And there are a couple of strategic actions which have been identified in that curriculum for Wales, which are well-intentioned, and we'll see how they pan out. I'm not sure that there's enough statutory support, but the will is certainly there. Northern Ireland is the only part of the UK at the moment without a statutory primary languages programme. So I'm not going to say much more about those different settings, but just to say it is quite a complicated picture when you try to look at what has been achieved in the UK since 1945. It's quite complicated. So I'm going to jump in with what things I have got to say, and I am really focusing on England. So 1960s were the good old days, and I think that already came out in Simon's paper yesterday. So some of the optimism of the 1960s is reflected in a number of reports which really did lead to change. So 1962, there was an Annan report on the teaching of Russian, which made the case for expanding the teaching of Russian, but also made some other recommendations which were listened to about languages more generally. 1963, the Newsom report, Half Our Future, about pupils of all abilities having access to language learning, and I'll come back to that. The Parry report on Latin America studies led to a real policy change, which didn't do anything about Spanish in schools directly, but it set up specialist university centres for Latin American studies, which did help promote Latin American and Hispanic studies more generally at university and create the expertise. And the 1960s also saw the introduction of a compulsory year abroad at more and more universities, which made a real change to language teachers' spoken skills. And Eric Hawkins was already referenced by Anka this morning, Anka Wiegner's paper. You can't see me, can you see me? Anyway, that's the book that he wrote. That book absolutely fizzes with his enthusiasm on all the new initiatives that were happening in the 1960s. And he called it the An Annus Mirabilis 1963-64, when one of the exam boards got rid of prose translation into the foreign language. And that was the result of a recommendation by the Annan report on Russian. Other optimistic things that were happening in the 1960s, language centres were being set up at universities. And as Simon mentioned yesterday in his paper, new kinds of undergraduate degree courses were also being set up, which focused more on applied language and moved away from the philological and literary approach to languages degrees. New developments in methodologies are reflected in the birth of the Audiovisual Language Teaching Association, which then morphed into various other things and is now the Association for Language Learning, indirectly morphed into that. And also an explosive growth of, I'm quoting here, Eric Hawkins, explosive growth of in-service work promoting language teaching expertise. So both government inspectors, but also language advisors based in the local education authorities who advised teachers, produced materials, gave in-service support to improve teaching on the ground. And the National Association of Language Advisors, you can see the logo there, grew strongly over that decade of the 60s to 70s and produced sometimes quite usable little publications. So Duncan Sidwell, quite local to me, in Leicestershire, which was a very forward-looking education authority at the time, produced something about adult learning strategies and approaches for modern language learning. So it was also thinking about new audiences for language learning. So just fleshing out a little bit more the thought about languages for all, and coming back to the Newsom report called Half Our Future. So the idea that half of the populace was sort of just not being thought about and given the same opportunities as the more privileged. It's clear that very large numbers of boys and girls, including most of our average as well as below average pupils, have had no opportunity to learn a foreign language. And the Newsom report suggests that this would be a good idea to do. It will raise language awareness. They don't quite use that label, but it would help them to think about their use of words and language in their own language. It might be a way of creating confidence in pupils who are not necessarily strong in their own language or in other subjects, but will have stimulus and fresh energy. And also, we accept that in other parts of the world, especially in other parts of Europe, children of generally limited ability or not particularly brilliant ability are perfectly able to learn a language. So why don't we believe that? And then also the growth of an interest in languages for tourism appealing to language peoples. Alongside that hope of comprehensive education, there was also grand hopes of primary languages. And again, this is a 1960s initiative that, because this England was quite complicated, it involved a government, considerable input from the Nuffield Foundation, a really important educational charity, and university researchers, for a joint programme of development work to introduce French into primary schools. French because it was the leading language and closest neighbour, and it was decided that one language needed to be focused on. So this was really epoch-making, I think, in the scale of the support being given to the pilot scheme, with 18,000 pupils involved in 124 schools in 13 different local education authorities, and watched really closely, and with many other schools interested and perhaps implementing something, in, even if they weren't part of the pilot. It was supported by the Nuffield Foundation's Foreign Language Teaching Materials project, which resulted in various teaching materials. So you've got En Avant on your screen here, and if you can see me, I don't know if you can, Vorwärts, the German equivalent, there's one for Spanish as well. There's some nice archive footage of that being used, actually. So I didn't have the courage to attempt to switch to that archive, but if you follow the link in the slides, you would can find that and have a look at it yourselves. So it was quite unprecedented in the amount of investment of public funds to promote languages. I'm going to come back to those two initiatives later on. What I want to do now is think about the some key voices that have been involved in discussions since 1945, just focusing on a few. So one really important one was the Committee on Research and Development in Modern Languages, or the CDRML, which was brought into being in 1964 and had an existence for about 6 years. Really telling, I think, the title, Research and Development, that is a sort of a term from industry or from the sciences. This is a new approach, right? To do this properly, we need to know what research is needed and what we should be recommending as a result of that research. So it was recognizing a need for a central body to coordinate activities to promote research and development in the field of modern languages. A brilliant idea, and we will recognize that when I come up closer to the present day. It produced two reports in 1968 and 1971, and it implemented a number of important things, although at the time that it closed its final report in 1971, still said there remain large gaps in our knowledge of ascertainable facts on such matters as which foreign languages are being taught, to how many, by how many, for how long, for what purpose, and to what level of competence. And I think after I've just given you that overview of how our system works, you can probably understand why it's not that easy to get those answers. The Centre of Information on Language Teaching, or SILT, was one of the outcomes of CRDML, established in 1966. And as Simon mentioned in his paper yesterday, it was a really, really important organisation in supporting language teaching. Lots of publications, some more research oriented, some really translating insights into practical things that teachers could use in the classroom. It carried on its existence in England. Well, it was a UK-wide body, but carried on in England till 2011, when it was cut by the Conservative government and was merged with CFBT, which is the Something for British Conference for British Teachers. So, anyway, an organisation for teaching more widely, not just language teaching. Meanwhile, in Scotland, SILT continues, and in Northern Ireland, SILT continues on a much reduced budget. So again, the devolution of powers means that things are quite different across the country now. But that was a really important organisation while it lasted. Another important voice increasingly is the British Council, which might seem a bit counterintuitive because the British Council is all about promoting English abroad, you would think, but actually their mission is wider than that. As you can see there, I've just taken this from their website. to create, so yes, their mission is to create in a country overseas a basis of friendly knowledge and understanding of this country, but also more broadly developing closer cultural relations between the UK and other countries. And the British Council has really taken on board that aspect of relationship building, particularly by taking over the language assistance scheme in 1992. So that's the scheme that brings foreign language assistance to the UK and also sends them to other countries. And it's also playing an increasing role in foreign languages advocacy. So it serves as the secretariat for the All Parliamentary Group for Languages that I mentioned a few slides back. And it's begun to produce lots of important reports, such as this one, Languages for the Future in 2013. It's also collaborated with the British Academy. So quite an important voice. More recently, another body is the National Centre for Excellence for Language Pedagogy, or NCELP, which was established in 2018. With the initial, at the moment, it's linked to a number of specific secondary schools only, but it has the specific aim of significantly increasing uptake of languages at GCSE. So this is recognised to be a problem. Sorry, something's happened to my slide there. Initial funding for 2 million with potential for a further, I think, 4 million is what this meant to say, hidden behind that logo that I've put there. Sorry. Okay. A theme that we all saw already in the 1960s was the need for some kind of national body to coordinate everything. And that was indeed the CRDML initially for that brief period. In 2000, another launch was made of a national languages strategy, and it was adopted and began to be implemented from 2002. And with one of its principles, to learn from what works, responding to a national languages national, as part of a languages national steering group. All was going well with various reports and lots of initiatives and enthusiasm, as you can see here. So it included the ambition that all primary school children will be entitled to study languages by 2012. That is because that great enthusiasm in the 1960s and early 70s the initiative that I was talking about actually ended in not being adopted and expanded beyond the pilot schools, because it was felt that it wasn't actually making enough difference to pupils' achievement. Quite controversial at the time. All young people will have the opportunity to learn languages and be motivated to do so, increasing the number of languages take up in higher education. Languages will be properly recognised and valued by society. That would be great. And various other initiatives. So that our national capability in languages will be transformed. Crucially important for a flourishing UK, and a pretty incisive analysis of the problem that educational provision is fragmented, achievement is poorly measured, continuity not very evident, a lack of joined up thinking, which again, if you look back to that framework that I was showing you and all the different moving parts, you can understand where that fragmentation comes from. So all agreed that the UK needs a change of policy and practice to fit us for the new millennium. However, that funding too was ended in 2011 with a change of government. So in 2020, if you just show the previous slide was a national language strategy. 2020, we're back to trying to get towards a national languages strategy. This was a report produced in 2020, just when COVID hit. So obviously implementing it has been quite difficult, although there are some things in the pipeline. What I like about this document that was produced, as you can see here, by the British Academy, the British Council, and various other voices, what I like is that it's quite concrete about who needs to do what, because a lot of the earlier documents that we've seen talk about something should happen, this needs to be done, but unless you actually attribute what needs to be done to an owner and make them accountable for it, it's going to be very difficult to implement. So let's see what comes of that. I'm going to finish by running through some of the questions about what has actually changed since 1945 and how that might relate to the advocacy and or policy of the last 50 years or so. So which languages are taught, what's taught and assessed, who gets to learn, and how much time is allocated. I'm starting with how much time is allocated, because you would think this would be a really simple question. The amount of classroom time allocated is really straightforward. Every subject gets the same amount of time. But this is actually not the case in England. And this was already noted in the Leith report of 1918, that the amount of time spent on languages varied quite a lot, still does today. So I have just been very parochial and referred to my local school where my children attend. You get a GCSE in maths and you get a GCSE in German. You do the same examination, but you get half as much time again for maths as you do for German. And I think the same would be true of English. And in other schools, it may be even starker than that, because Fernwood is actually quite committed to languages. So this is an example of the effect of a policy that has nothing to do with languages whatsoever, but has a big impact on people's experience of success, teachers' ability to prepare pupils for exams, and that is really decided at a very local level. So there isn't really anything that the government, the way the system works at the moment, can do to stipulate exactly how much time is spent on any one subject. Which languages are taught? I said in the abstract that I would talk about the case of Spanish, so I am going to say a little bit about that. Russian, there was a report on Russian, but also a report on Spanish in the 1960s, the Parry report on Latin American studies. But already the case for Spanish as a global language with global reach had been made since the early 20th century. I've quoted from a 1930 source there, but I could show you data from even further back in the 20th century. So the memorandum on the teaching of foreign languages in certain types of schools, beyond saying how useful it would be for the economy and that Britain was falling behind other European countries in its links with Latin America. It points out that Spanish is really easy to learn. It's a language of unusual simplicity and facility with clear and easy syntax, which all my colleagues in Spanish in the university would be, their hackles would rise at that, but nevertheless, that was the statement made. Despite all this advocacy, in the 1980s, the number of pupils taking Spanish was still way, way behind those taking French and even German. But it overtook German in 2001, and in 2014, Spanish is really quite well. Nowadays, Spanish is very close to French, and it's quite telling that when primary schools did introduce languages, which I'll come to in a moment, Spanish was the second most popular choice. About one in five schools picked Spanish. So I think what I'm trying to say here is that in the case of Spanish, it's very difficult to argue that advocacy and policy had much of an impact on the take up of Spanish. And what perhaps seems to have happened is that Spanish just became more attractive as a concept to society who were more exposed to Spanish through going on holiday and such like. And that may well be, rather than all these various efforts, that might have been the trigger from the 1980s onwards that really saw Spanish grow. It's worth noting that advocacy for other languages, particularly community languages, and to be assessed in some of these languages, have not had a great deal of impact. That table is just to show you the growth in Spanish. So you can see Spanish has grown and quite massively at A level. So that's the school leaving examination you take at 18-ish. What is taught and assessed? Here the changes have been top down, and I would argue are largely driven by assessment changes. So it's really important that assessment changes reflect what they reflect. There've been various updates, which I haven't got time to go into here, but I think it's worth noting most recently, right now, there is a consultation that has just closed on the on the content and assessment of exams, languages exams for 16 and up. The changes are always consulted on, but this I think perhaps is a case where the decisions are in the hands of a relatively small group of arbiters, to use that term, including at the moment NSELP, so the National Centre for Excellence in Language Pedagogy. And that's quite a controversial topic at the moment. Who gets to learn? Well, there has been significant change in that all pupils are indeed exposed to a language in primary school. This is something that, as I said, was first mooted in the 1960s and really explored with great enthusiasm, but then came to nothing. It was advocated again in the National Languages Strategy of 2002. And the argument was it should be carried through into the first years of secondary school. And I'm just going to check what I've got on the next slide. Yeah, okay. So it was implemented ultimately in primary schools in 2014. So once the Conservative government took over from Labour in 2011, the language strategy, as I said, was ceased to be funded. But that key recommendation of languages in primary school was ultimately introduced just a little bit later in 2014. It's also worth noting in terms of accessibility of languages to people of all different abilities, that for languages are available at different levels at GCSE. So there's a higher tier, but there's also a foundation tier for pupils who are less academic and who can nevertheless get a language qualification. Where are we now? So, I mean, there has been significant change in that 49% of all GCSE, so that's 16 plus pupils, took a language as one of their subjects. Pupils take, you know, on average about nine such subjects. The aim of the government is that pupils will have five good GCSEs. So 49%, that is less than half, but on the other hand, it is almost half. So I think it depends on your perspective compared to the past. However, the gains made in number of pupils continuing with the language onto a higher level have really declined. And I'll show you that in a moment. Private school pupils are really overrepresented in the number of people in the pupils taking a modern foreign language. And the number of pupils taking two languages is really, really small outside private schools. In comprehensive schools, it's often a choice between one or the other. And in academies, it's just in the non-private sector. Say a little bit more about the real desire to recognise achievement for all. So I saw that, talked about that already in the foundation level GCSE exams, but even that...
Even a subject doesn't really interest me right now, still is.
Sorry, have I got an interference from someone?
Yes, Ellen, could you switch off your microphone just for the moment, please, Ellen?
I've nearly finished, I promise. Coming back to the topic of recognising achievement at all different levels, a set of national language standards were established in 1993. So there have been various initiatives to attempt to recognise language learning, even if it's not through a standard GCSE or other school examination. So that was attempted in 1993. Something similar was tried again with a languages ladder set up as part of the National Languages Strategy in the early 2000s. Really ambitious. It was intended to provide language learning accreditation at 17 levels, starting lower than the CEFR, from beginner level right up to mastery, and for up to 25 languages. And it was particularly hoped that this would help people who spoke community language get some accreditation for it, even if that language wasn't widely taught at school, and also for workplace or vocational qualifications where you might not need a GCSE, but some kind of language competence could be recognised and useful. But despite those high hopes, it was discontinued in 2012. I think partly because it was probably quite, with 17 levels and 25 languages, you need an awful lot of take up. To make that feel from a managerial point of view that it's efficient, I suspect. So where are we now? Well, what can I say? That's where we are. So that's looking at A-level entry. So that is for pupils taking the exams that lead on to university. Remember, in the British system, you take only three subjects at the most, four really. At that exam level. So that too is a really good example of how a non-languages policy has a massive impact on what pupils are likely to take. So the fact that you take only three subjects, and if you're interested in sciences, you're probably going to take what is in effect double maths and physics, or maths, physics and chemistry, or maths, physics and English. There just isn't a lot of space for languages at A level at the moment. So that's it. And as Richard already kindly mentioned at the at the beginning, and so did Simon, I have just got a little bit of self-promotion, which is the project that Simon and I have been working on language teaching, learning from the past, which I will perhaps try and put in the chat afterwards, or maybe Simon might do it if he's listening. We have produced 5 video packages on various themes, reflecting on these themes, which I hope will be relevant to teachers today, but could be really useful for in-service teacher development, teacher training, on the topic of grammar, differentiation, use of the target language, policy and advocacy, and I can't remember what the 5th one is. Simon can tell me, remind me in a minute. So they are completely, they're intended for teacher trainers to use without needing any expertise. So there's a handbook for the instructor, and there's a handbook for the trainee teachers or for the in the teaching development group to work with, and very short videos. The videos that are up there at the moment were produced in lockdown, so they're not that sophisticated, but we are finally going to be able to film them properly in July, and so they'll be replaced by all singing, dancing, sophisticated versions of Simon and me rather than seeing our homes at the moment. So that's enough self-promotion. I'll leave it there and pass over to Richard to say
yes,
give our questions. Thank you, everybody.